So, I try to break something. That's always a good thing to do. Lamentations chapter 2. You were, I think, all here last week. So I don't need to review for you. We did a lot of introduction with chapter 1. There'll be less introduction here. I think we can just follow the fact that we believe it's Jeremiah who is mourning the loss, grieving the loss of not only Jerusalem, but the nation, of their failure, their sin, their judgment, their captivity. And yet the glimmers of hope will start to rise within this before we're done with it. And we'll just begin in chapter 2, verse 1 through 3. How the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud of his anger. He cast down from heaven to the earth the beauty of Israel. Did not remember his footstool in the day of his anger. The Lord has swallowed up and has not pitied. All the dwelling places of Jacob he has thrown down in his wrath, the strongholds of the daughters of Judah. He has brought them down to the ground. He has profaned the kingdom and its princes. He has cut off in fierce anger every horn of Israel. He's drawn back his right hand from before the enemy. He has blazed against Jacob like a flaming fire, devouring all around. So if you thought it was going to get easier, it's not. Not right now. Now, this isn't for God that he writes, but it's for those who are really truly lamenting. And for those through history, us, who would see the results of God's judgment on Judah. Now, here's a question for you, and I mean that you can answer. What is good about this? I thought you'd have an answer, but you might. What is good about what we're reading here? That it's a lesson we can learn. Does that make sense to you guys? They're not so sure, Jeff. Okay, let me tell you one thing. I think that's a good point. Let me tell you one thing. There's awareness in what we're reading that this wasn't just by chance. This wasn't just evil men doing as they please, meaning the Babylonians. God never lost control of the situation. It's God. He's going to read a little bit more where it's going to really clearly state it in the next verses. This is God doing this. So that means God is not out of control. It's not chance. It's not like evil just gets to go wherever it wants and we have no hope of just maybe crossing our fingers and hope that bad doesn't happen. The bad that's happening here is a direct result of sin and judgment. And that would be important for Judah to accept and in order for them to revive from this, in order to get over. You know, I have talked with people, perhaps you have, and maybe I've been that person some, but I just don't understand what's happening. I just don't get it. And if you follow their life, it's as clear as this noonday sun why they're in that spot. Maybe with your kids. You say, I don't understand how did I get a D? How did I get an F? Well, how much of your homework did you do? Zero. Do you remember that time we said, that's the easy one. We can put it on our kids. Unfortunately, I know many adults where 20 years later are still going, I don't get why it's like this. And they haven't now, there's things we don't understand no matter who we are. I'm not talking about everything. I'm talking about that measure where you've clearly been in disobedience to God and you've been reaping what you sowed, and yet you are not accepted that that's exactly what's going on. I think everybody's been there, really. And so it's important. It's important to see it in its right framework. Verses 4 and 5. Standing like an enemy, he has bent his bow with his right hand like an adversary. He has slain all who were pleasing to his eye. On the tent of the daughter of Zion, he has poured out his fury like fire. The Lord was like an enemy. He has swallowed up Israel. He has swallowed up all her palaces. He has destroyed her strongholds and has increased mourning and lamentation in the daughter of Judah. God did it. Okay, do you see that? God bent his bow. God brought the judgment in the same light as he never lost control, and it's an awareness that it's just not evil being running rampant with nobody in control. We see that God brought the judgment, as we see elsewhere. God is no respecter of persons. And, whether it's the leaders or the people at the lowest, the palaces to all the daughters of Jerusalem, and this is important, God is no respecter of persons. How difficult is it to embrace a chastening if it's done with favoritism? Think about when you were a kid, or your kids, if you have kids, plural, and one kid gets punished for the same thing very differently from another kid because of favoritism. That would give you a reason to stumble, Now, there's another side to this, in that speaking about God being no respecter of persons, it's not done with favoritism. That means if you've seen favoritism in that way in a family, if you've seen it in a job situation, reward and demotion based on favoritism, or you've seen it in the church or something like that, there is. On the other hand, there's a sensitivity. Certainly a parent needs that. My son and my daughter were two different people, and we didn't discipline them exactly the same. I'm not suggesting that everybody should have exactly the same, from a parental standpoint, discipline. This is different. I just want to state it, is that if a child's truly repentant, then you're very quick to restore that situation. If they're hardened in rebellion, either one, boy or girl, then you have to work a little harder at the discipline and hold your ground. You also know that one kid you could look at and they just start crying as soon as you look at them. And another one is just obstinately lying to you, and you have to kind of do more with them. That's okay, right? That's being discerning, and God knows how to do that too. So it isn't that everything has to be exactly the same, and reward and pun especially reward, the reward side. Matthew chapter 20 clears that up. The guys that worked all day were complaining because the guys that worked for an hour, and the master said, "What's it your business if I decide to bless these guys?" So there's a whole other, that's a whole side. We're talking about here. I know I'm expanding, but coming back to the actual point here is that God was not a respecter of persons, and the entire nation, they could look at each other. You're going to hear about them sitting in the dirt, the leaders. It's like they're all going to know we all failed. We're all suffering together. There's a health in that, facing it. The worst thing we can do is not face things. And so, comments? 6 through 9. He has done violence to his tabernacle as if it were a garden, kind of like he rototilled it up, right? He has destroyed his place of assembly. The Lord has caused the appointed feasts and the Sabbaths to be forgotten in Zion. In his burning indignation, he has spurned the king and the priest. The Lord has spurned his altar. He has abandoned his sanctuary, has given up the wall of her palaces into the hand of the enemy. They have made a noise, and the house of the Lord is on the day of set feast, meaning the enemies were like partying and shouting. The Lord has purposed to destroy the wall of the daughter of Zion. He has stretched out a line. He has not withdrawn his hand from destroying. Therefore, he has caused the rampart and wall to lament. They languished together. Her gates have sunken to the ground. He has destroyed and broken her bars. Her kings and her princes are among the nations. The law is no more, and her prophets find no vision from the Lord. So, whether it's the temple itself, as we talked about in detail last week, and the whole coming to Jerusalem, or the palace, and the enemy celebrating loudly, it's a rebuke to all the false worship that had got on and on and on by the leadership and the people. And so the picture that you have in Deuteronomy, as well as in Leviticus, and probably in Numbers, some places it said the same thing. God says, Israel, just follow me and honor me, and no one will be able to hurt you. No one will be able to touch you. You know, as again, one of you will chase 10,000. But if you do the same thing that these people are doing and completely turning away from me, I will have no choice. And he didn't even say it that way. I'm trying to make it that way. He says, what I will do is just as I sought to do good for you, I will seek you out for judgment. And he warned them explicitly of exactly what we're reading that they're mourning over. Okay. So we're in the first section. What's good about this? Awareness. It wasn't by chance. God's no respecter of persons. That's a good thing to know. And number three, he was faithful to keep his word. And he had told them clearly what would happen. And that's what happened. So, a rebuke to the false worship that had gone. This didn't go on for 20 years. This didn't go on for 50 years. This didn't go on for 100 years. This went on for hundreds of years with little brief moments of revival. You will not find in the Bible anywhere a permanent revival. I don't believe there is such a thing. Well, they had a revival, and that took care of everything. Some of you, I don't know if anybody, when you came to Jesus, but probably Gail and I being senior and having come to the Lord early in our lives during that time, that was a great revival. It didn't. It had great ramifications, you know, to this very day. But it didn't. It didn't just keep going. Whitfield, what's this? George Whitfield, in New England, in the 1700s, he came over here a bunch of times. Revival up and down the Eastern Seaboard. Amazing, amazing. Churches had already turned into bars there. Not just like it now. And it had been. I mean, things were going south, and there was terrible stuff happening, and Whitfield comes over, as well as Finney, as well as some of these other great guys, and boom, incredible revival. And it was real. Did it last? No. Jonathan Edwards, great revival. You can go to Enfield, Connecticut. Is it Connecticut? Massachusetts. You can go to Enfield, and you can see statues and things, and right next to you will be a transgender flag, you know, state government teaching all other kinds of garbage, right where there was a great revival. So doesn't mean we don't want revival, right? We don't control 20, 30, 40 years from now. We have hope for the future, but we have hope for the kids. But God also promised them just as much the judgment as he did the blessing. And their prophets, over this period of time, and especially towards the end during Jeremiah's 40 years, those prophets had been speaking, and even when, and you do already know this, but I'll remind you, even as there's captives in Babylon, prophets there are saying, you know, they're sitting by the river, everybody's weeping, and they're, you know, Jeremiah's words, by the river Chebar, they're here and there in Babylon, And they have prophets going, no, no, in 2 years, 2 full years, we'll be back. This will all end. These Babylonians will stop pushing on us and we'll be home. And the people believed them. They believed what they wanted to believe. A point comes when they faced the foolishness of their false prophecies. And now as God's no respecter of persons and the whole thing's done, everyone knows that God's judgment is real. Full measure. And there were prophets, real prophets, like Jeremiah. And do you remember there was another prophet that actually ran away and he got chased and killed, but he was doing a good prophecy. And there were a couple other guys around. And there was Josiah earlier too. It's not like there was no voices to be heard for truth. They were the few and the far between, but they were there. And vision was available. The ability to see was available. And it's very much, may I say, like that right now, as many in our own land reject the clear teaching of God's word. It's not everywhere. I don't want to join the crew that every week gets up and complains about the failing of the church and where it's going. I don't want to, like, every week, like, bah, bah, bah. You know what I'm saying? But, I mean, as you're reading this, you have to think about these things. It's really hard not to. It's like, when you find that, I mean, we pray that not only that President Trump will come fully to Jesus, but that his spiritual advisors will change. I mean, in terms of this Paula White, just false prophetess kind of stuff and name it and claim it stuff. If you read the things that she says and teaches, it's garbage. May I say it more clearly? It just is. It just is. And I know there's other biblical Christians that speak into his life, etc. And the point is for God to speak into his life. And it's not just him. It's all our leadership. And it's not like it's all going to change and they're all going to become Christians. The point is that those voices are few and far between. And when you see people ignoring the law, the statutes, the judgments, the truth, you know, what's ahead for those who rewrite the Bible to fit their own narrative? You know, the guy who's running for office, there's a guy in Texas that's not a Christian, claims the Bible in incredibly horrific ways. But he's not alone. They're on your street corners. There's households. There's people going to churches. There's people staying home from church and saying, I got God. I got Jesus. I got the Bible. And they're making up their own religion every day. Part of our gathering together, it isn't like, oh, our church is the best and Rick Cohen always has the truth. It's the accountability factor to face each other and open the Bible and say, what's it saying here? And to actually look at each other and go, are you and I following the truth? You know, our home groups or meeting like this or whatever, like, are we following Jesus? You know, because we aren't claiming, oh, we just tell everybody the truth and we're the best and we know it all. That's just arrogance. But we also should truly be aware of these things. You can't make the Bible fit your own brain. And it's never pretty when judgment comes and it's unavoidable. Because every one of us will face God, and those who are rebelling against him will face him in their rebellion unless they repent. Thoughts, comments? Happy days? Verses 10 through 11. The elders of the daughter of Zion sit on the ground and keep silence. They throw dust on their heads and gird themselves with sackcloth. The virgin daughters of Jerusalem bow their heads to the ground. My eyes fail with tears, my heart's troubled, my bile is poured on the ground because of the destruction of the daughters of my people, because the children and the infants faint in the streets of the city. Very hard words, right? And it wasn't the last time this would happen. Listen to what Jesus said in his day to Jerusalem after she's restored. God has done what he promised. He brought them back. And now, 400 years later, after they're, after they're back and the temple's rebuilt. He talks about John the Baptist and says, "What'd you go out in the wilderness to see?" That whole story, Luke chapter 7. And it says, "And when the people heard him, even the tax collectors justified God, having been baptized with the baptism of John. But the Pharisees and lawyers rejected the will of God for themselves, not having been baptized by him." And while the common people did hear Jesus gladly, nationally they did reject him. And it wasn't just the leaders, but there were common people that heard him, and the church was birthed with Jews. But here's what Jesus says. "And the Lord said, 'To what then shall I liken the men of this generation?'" This is Jesus. "To what shall I liken the men of this generation?" Or what are they like? "They are like children sitting out in the marketplace, calling to one another, saying, 'We played the flute, and you did not dance. We mourned, and you did not weep. For John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine, and you say he has a demon. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, Look, a glutton, a wine bibber, and a friend of tax collectors and sinners. But wisdom is justified of all her children. We played the flute and you didn't dance. We mourned and you didn't mourn. We played a dirge. We wept." And here that's a revisiting of this very same kind of issue where they didn't mourn when they needed to mourn. They did not mourn until all they had was mourning. You and I should remember that. When I read the verses in Ecclesiastes chapter 7 last week. "It's better to go to the house of mourning than the house of laughter, for the living will lay it to heart." And in both cases, not only mourning for your sin, I think the idea to say, "Well, I'm just forgiven, God forgives me," without ever going, "Man, what I did was really wrong." I mean, we're not supposed to not mourn at all for our sin. "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." Now, if you languish in mourning, that's another story. But if you haven't mourned for your sin ever, I don't know if you understand what sin really is and what it does. Now, if I meet somebody and they're mourning for 3 years over what happened 3 years ago, and they haven't really found the freedom of forgiveness, I'm going to minister to them of the freedom of forgiveness. But there are people that just never mourn their sin. And they don't have a depth in their relationship with God. These guys didn't mourn when they should have, so now they're mourning because they have nothing else but mourning for the moment. That's a hard thing, isn't it? Yeah. And the living will lay it to heart. And he's not, this Jeremiah and God are not gloating over being right. God, Jeremiah isn't gloating here if he's the writer. He's grieving over the necessity of the judgment. They had made themselves Jeremiah's enemy, but more importantly, they had made themselves God's enemy. And God only makes you his enemy. He actually doesn't. You make yourself his enemy. I could show you verses where that are clear on this, and certainly in Ephesians and Colossians where it says, we are enemies to God in our mind by wicked works. That's our doing. That's our nature, our fallen nature. It's not God saying, I've made you my enemy. There's places where God says, I'm making you my enemy, but that's because they already, in every case, they are those who have made themselves an enemy to him. So God only responds to man's decisions to be an enemy to God. Verse 12, children who don't understand, that's my thought, that's not the scripture. I'm reading my commentary. They say to their mothers, where's the grain and wine? And they swoon like the wounded in the streets of the city, and their life is poured out in their mother's bosom. You know, this is just so hard. And there's people who stumble over this greatly because God should protect children. So in order for God to protect children, he has to take away the free will of adults. Do you get that? If to want God to protect children is like everything else we want God to do to fix wrong. It's all part of the wrong. And I've said this many times. I think I even said it last Sunday. In order for God to fix the wrong out there, and yet I'm not willing for him to fix the wrong in me and let him be in control of me. I can't ask him, demand of him. I can ask him. I can't demand of him that he fixes stuff that has the repercussions of human decision making. Sometimes in his mercy he will, obviously, but these children who don't understand what's going on are looking for sustenance from their parents, and it's the deep, dismal result of their rebellion against God, and their children suffer the weight of their sin, and today that happens just so too. And we've seen our culture take a nosedive. It isn't one generation down. It's been going down, and children suffer the weight of the parents' sin. I don't mean they get punished for it. I mean they suffer from the result of it. You never sin just to yourself. It does affect other people. 13 through 17. How shall I console you? To what shall I liken you, O daughter of Jerusalem? What shall I compare with you that I may comfort you? O virgin daughter of Zion, for your ruin is spread wide as a sea, who can heal you? Your prophets have seen for you false and deceptive visions. They've not uncovered your iniquity to bring back your captives, but have envisioned for you false prophecies and delusions. All who pass by clap their hands at you. They hiss and shake their head. Do you know that's what they did to Jesus as he was on the cross, paying for the sin? They hiss and shake their heads. And the daughter of Jerusalem, and is this city that is called the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth? All your enemies have opened their mouth against you. They hiss and gnash with their teeth. They say, "We have swallowed her up. Surely this is the day we've waited for. We have found it and we have seen it. The Lord has done what he purposed. He has fulfilled his word, which he commanded in the days of old. He's thrown down and not pitied. He has caused an enemy to rejoice over you. He has exalted the horn of your adversaries." You know, how shall I console you, really? How do you console these captives in the midst of their punishment? Well, what we've already been talking about is they can't until they face reality. Okay. They'd listened to the false prophets for so long, as we read here, believed the self-serving lies, and they do become a witness. Yes, they're a witness of what happens through obstinate disobedience to God. Everybody is a witness. You know, there's a witness of obeying God, and there's a witness of disobeying God. What psalm, see who knows, what psalm in verse 15 is being quoted? Is this the city that is called the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth? Yeah, which is Psalm 4. I knew she'd get it when you said that. Psalm 48. Yeah. Let me take you to Psalm 48. They went from this to that, and I just want to show it to you. It won't take long. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, and the city of our God is his holy mountain. Beautiful in elevation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. God is in her palaces, he's known as her refuge. For behold, the kings assembled, they passed by together, they saw it and they marveled, they were troubled and they hastened away. Fear took hold of them, and in pain as a woman in birth pangs, as when you break the ships of Tarshish with an east wind. He's talking about the enemies, not Israel here. That they were victorious and strengthened in God. As we have seen, heard, so have we seen in the city of the Lord, in the city of our God. God will establish it forever. We have thought, O God, on your loving kindness in the midst of your temple, according to your name, O God. For so is your praise to the ends of the earth. Your right hand is full of righteousness. Let Mount Zion rejoice. Let the daughters of Judah be glad because of your judgments. Walk around Zion and go around her, count her towers, mark well her bulwarks, consider her palaces, that you may tell it to the generation following. For this is God, our God, forever and ever. He will be our guide even to death. By the way, that verse 14, and that was Gail and my verse that we put on our wedding invitations. And people said, why did you write even unto death? Because till death do us part. You know, that's what we're looking at there. We think it's great. Now, notice, here's this absolutely strengthened, positive, God is sovereign, controlling, Israel will always be here, psalm, forever. And it's true, because he brought him back. But it's that, you know, I'll rejoice over you to strengthen you, and I'll rejoice to punish you so that you can be dealt with, so that you can be restored, because I'm not done with you. But isn't that kind of overwhelming? And so to go from that psalm and the victory of God, and therefore it's like you can't say, you know, because God's with us and we've been great, we don't have to worry about anything, we'll always be great. No, we need to have a fresh daily walk with the Lord. So God allows the enemies to mock, to be his tool to judge, but it's not over, not even till the fat lady sings. It's not over till God comes back, and eventually they'll remember, that God speaks to them, not just all these words of lamentations, but they'll be reminded that God says, build houses, plant vineyards, marry your children to each other, and build a life in this place where you feel completely isolated, because I'm not done with you. So don't give up, even with all of this pain. And they will get up, but if for the moment they are going through the deep mourning, and you may say, gosh, five chapters of this is a lot. Well, it's not a lot if you're millions of people who have lived for centuries under God's direction and been rebellious and are suffering the weight of it. It's again me trying to think of Portland the same way Lesha would think of her hometown, or these guys would think of Jerusalem. It's just I don't have a reference point as deeply as these people do. But certainly there's people that have gone through great, great mourning and have actually found comfort in Lamentations, because it has an end. And they can walk through it and feel like, instead of just feeling guilty for mourning, they can allow the mourning to come out, and then they can allow the hope to come in. Okay, so we're going to read verses 18 through 22, and I'm not going to comment a lot afterwards. I will share a thought or two with you, and then you'll see. It's just more of the same great difficulty. Their heart cried out to the Lord, O wall of the daughter of Zion, let tears run down like a river day and night. Give yourself no relief, give your eyes no rest. Arise, cry out in the night at the beginning of the watches. Pour out your heart like water before the face of the Lord. Lift your hands towards him for the life of your young children who faint from hunger at the head of every street. See, O Lord, and consider, to whom have you done this? Should the women eat their offspring, the children they have cuddled? Should the priest and prophet be slain in the sanctuary of the Lord? Young and old lie on the ground in the streets. My virgin and my young men have fallen by the sword. You've slain them in the day of your anger. You have slaughtered and not pitied. You have invited us to a feast day, the terrors that surround me. In the day of the Lord's anger, there was no refugee or survivor. Those whom I have borne and brought up, my enemies have destroyed. One more general comment about the judgment, and that is that violence in the earth was happening and going to happen anyway, you know. Have you ever heard of Hiroshima and Nagasaki? This, I don't attribute that to God. and even done to try to end a war and keep the bloodshed low. I'm not judging the government of the United States for that. I'm not smart enough to know those things completely. I just know that man is already killing himself. And a lot of us have trouble reading about God bringing judgment, and he uses people to do it. Sometimes he doesn't. In Revelation, it's going to come out of the heavens, but it's going to be necessary. And if you take God out of the picture, you don't take pain and suffering out of the picture. If you take God out of the picture, we're left with the complete wickedness of man to destroy each other anyway. This is healing judgment, but it's also still really, really hard. Women eating their own. Well, Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26, 29 said, this is what you will do when you have rebelled against me to full measure. You will end up doing these things. The only story we have of that is in 2 Kings 6 in Samaria, not Jerusalem. We don't have a direct story in Jerusalem, but we do have a direct story where the ladies come out to the king and they're being sieged by the Syrians. No, the Assyrians? Syrians. And they go, these two ladies, hey, yesterday we ate her my kid, and she said today we could eat her kid, and now she won't give me her kid. And the king tears his clothes, and like they actually were doing that. And the soft sort of cannibalism that they, not soft, sort of cannibalism that they went through like that is just hard for us. And so what I'm going to say is here is that we don't blame women for this, but men and women, both directly in it and in our entire culture, because Daniel in chapter 9, on their way back from Babylon, prayed as a man who was part of his fallen people and took responsibility for the sin with his nation. Do you understand what I'm talking about? In Daniel 9, Daniel says, Lord, to us belongs shame of face and sorrow because we've sinned against you. But you're righteous and holy. Have mercy now and bring us back like you promised, but not because of our righteousness, because we have failed you. He had fasted and mourned and wept and sorrowed. Did Daniel do any of that stuff? No. But he included himself with his people as part of the problem. If all we do is say those people out there, we are not going to find success in our walk with God. And we're not going to find an intercessor's heart. So when I say in our entire culture, since Roe v. Wade was initiated in 1973, perhaps you already know these numbers, 63 million legal abortions occurred in the United States. And then, since 2022, when it was reversed national, the total number of abortions has not lowered, it has risen, with over 1 million, or roughly 2,800 per day, occurring. And the most recent statistic I found was in 2023. I didn't look any further, I thought it's enough. 2,800 abortions a day. The only hope for Israel was to cry out to the Lord. And I think we should spend some time crying out to the Lord for our nation and for the sin that's going on here. We don't have women eating babies, and we're not blaming women. It's men and women to make this happen. We have babies being killed in the womb. We have children being mutilated in transgender false concept of that. We have kids being taught things that are going to lead them, even if they're not having an abortion or being transgendered, they're being led down a horrific path that's plaguing our country today. And I just don't want to talk anymore. I want to pray. But I'll play a couple of songs in it. And if you're able to pray, pray. I mean, everybody can pray, but if you're able to pray out loud as we pray, do that. Because it's an offering to the Lord.